chaotic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts. They'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Shivering in the subterranean darkness while the wind howls through the blasted ruins of civilization above this week is Robert Sherman. A multiple award-winning English writer, he enjoyed success early on when he became the youngest ever person to be made resident dramatist of the Royal Theatre in Exeter, where he worked often with Alan Ayckbourn, while his controversial play, Easy Laughter, was staged by none other than Francis Ford Coppola. A writer of short stories, novels, including 2020's We All Hear Stories in the Dark, and scripts, he's best known by Doctor Who fans for penning numerous Big Finish classics, including The Holy Terror, The Chimes of Midnight, and Jubilee, the latter of which he loosely adapted for 2005's TV Doctor Who episode, Dalek. Robert, hello.
Hello there. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Nice to see you, Ian. Yeah, I'm good. It's nice to hear those credits back. I've never really worked with Cop. I mean, it's one of those awful things. He produced a play of mine, by which I think he put all the money in. But I've been, you know, it's one of those things that when you start off in your career and you want to impress people, you allow the credits to be as expansive as you can. And so it was true that there was a production in Minneapolis, I think, of that play, which Coppola or his company Zoetrope produced. But it makes it sound like, whereas the Ayckbourn thing is totally true. But that was at Scarborough. That was a different theatre. But I worked with him for about 10 years, and that was extraordinary.
Oh, was that in your 20s as well? That must have been.
Yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I was so young. I mean, it was 1991, 1992, I began writing. And I was still at university when all that happened.
Wow.
And I just stuck in theatre. I never thought I'd leave theatre. Theatre was my great love. I mean, it still is, really. I just haven't written it for quite a few years now. But it's something which I just totally adored and never thought for a moment that, you know, I'd ever end up in TV. I never really wanted to end up in TV. And also at the time, of course, Doctor Who was dead. And so you just did your own thing. I was really a comedy writer. So it's that sort of, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Doctor Who then comes along, upsets the apple cart.
Yeah, but writing, like many writers, it's just been always there as a thing. This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. It came out of the fact that I had a really terrible stammer, which I still have. I mean, I still have a bit of a stammer, but I've found ways over the years to mask it. So people generally can't tell that, even as I'm talking to you now, my brain is flitting in different directions, trying to find replacement words for what I was about to say because I suddenly can't say it. It's that funny thing. Whereas when I began doing acting at school, and alongside people like David Walliams, who was the year below me. And I suddenly found that being on stage, I mean, I was terrible, but I could shout a lot, and I just fell in love with it. And I went along to National Youth Theatre when I was about 17, 18, and they told me how awful I was. and I, through that, began to want to still be involved in theatre. So I began writing it. And I think with a view first to, you know, I could write plays, I could be it. And then very, very quickly realised that I wouldn't want anyone as bad as me to be ruining the play I'd written. So I was, you know, churning out these things rather than doing my degree. And by the time I graduated, I was already, you know, getting quite a lot of work. And it was terrific. You know, I mean, I was incredibly grateful for the stammer to have done that. But yeah, I always wanted to be a writer as a result. I mean, writing was just the only thing, actually, that I felt I was any good at, you know, and still is. I mean, I'm useless at almost everything. And I'm useless often at writing. It's just that some days when the wind is in the right direction, the writing does still work. So I just stick at it.
It's that Vonnegut quote about writing enables a person who is stupid through redrafting to look like a genius just momentarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've written so much that's dreadful. I mean, I've had so much that's dreadful. Even that's the joy of theatre as well, is that, you know, things are so ephemeral. A word that I learned from Enlightenment. But you know, you would do a production, and I had some dreadful productions of really not very good plays, and then people forget. This was the days before the internet, so you could have a career learning your craft and people wouldn't see how badly you'd done it. I mean, I think I kept on getting work because I kept on getting work. People would say, oh, well, he's got a fair few credits now. And they would commission me again, and then they'd realise sometimes halfway through the process, oh, he's not very good, is he? But never mind, we'll, you know, we have to stage it now. And so you just keep going. Whereas I think if you work in TV or books, which is what I mostly do now, people can see the evidence of how bad you were because it's still on the shelf in some way. So, yeah, I owe theatre a great deal.
Yeah, me too. We're similar ages, and my writing.
Yes.
My writing career started, well, journalism, and then later suddenly discovered plays and theatre.
Yeah, that's fun.
But after years of journalism. But we're here because of a little-known show called Doctor Who. How much did it shape you as a child? How much were you, like they always say about our generation, Terence Dix taught us to read. How much was that kind of part of your, are you a writer because of Doctor Who?
In part, I suppose. I mean, yeah, I mean, sometimes I feel that that's the case. I spent so many years trying to avoid it when I was a kid, because I'm born in 1970, so my formative years would have been Tom Baker, but I couldn't watch Tom Baker. I found him too frightening. I found the title sequence, you know, that time tunnel would just make me run from the room. I mean, my earliest memories of Doctor Who are, I know I caught a bit of the Sunmakers part four, but my memory is, you know, of the collector going down the drain at the end of part four. And I wouldn't have watched it because I'd have been too frightened. So and it was odd because I was a very, very nervous kid. Anything that seemed like horror to me was automatically Doctor Who. So and that sounds silly, but you know, those ghost stories for Christmas in my head were Doctor Who. If I was shown video at school, because I lived near lots of farms, which showed you the dangers of, you know, playing near slurry because you'd drown in it. Apaches, that's the awful, terrible film that they would show at schools. That for me in my head was also Doctor Who. Doctor Who just symbolised for me fear. And so I didn't go anywhere near it. I just actively avoided it. And it was very odd that I became a fan of it. And I did so accidentally. I became a fan of Hitchhikers when I was about 10. My English teacher recommended it to me. And he had a recording of the radio series. Mm. And they just had the first book. And I read that and I loved it. And somebody at school told me that Douglas Adams had written Doctor Who. And I always like to believe it wasn't me being stupid, that this was actually what I was told, but it may just have been me being stupid. I began to believe that Douglas Adams wrote all of Doctor Who under a pseudonym. So I dared myself to investigate Doctor Who, thinking that Terence Dix, with the novelizations, was actually Douglas Adams under another name. And I remember reading my first few novelizations, finding connections and saying, oh, yes, well, I can tell this is Douglas Adams' style. Because I so much wanted more Hitchhiker. And so I kind of dared myself to try it. You know, it was that odd thing. And when I fell in love with it, I fell in love with it really, really hard. So from the ages of about 11, which is when The Five Faces was repeated, and I caught bits of that. And but my first proper season I sat down to watch was season 19. And by the time I did that, you know, Davison's first series, I'd already bought the Jean-Marc Le Fissier programme. So I'd made myself a fan of it through not only the novelizations in a few months, but also through factual guidebooks before I'd ever seen a story, which is stupid, but that's kind of the way I did it. So I went into Castro Malva telling my sister, watching it with me, what all the references were. You know, when you've got the bit where Davison's going down a corridor saying, come along, Brigadier, if the Ice Warriors don't get there first. I remember saying to my sister, well, actually, the Brigadier have never met the Ice Warriors. Even though I'd actually never seen the Brigadier in action, and I'd never seen an Ice Warrior story. I mean, I sort of became it's very me. I kind of get very committed very, very quickly. If I say I'm going to be a fan of something, I have to be a fan of it immediately. So I became, so I went from 0 to 100 miles an hour with Doctor Who without having actually seen it.
A zealotry of the new convert. But
And it made me into a real bore. I mean, I was terrible at school. I mean, from the ages of maybe into about 15, I still got a friend because we did a fanzine together, Owen Bywater, who is named in Dalek. And we did a fanzine, and he would tell me, you know, he's a few years older than me, and he would say just how tedious I was, because all I could talk about was Doctor Who. It was my only conversation point. And my parents were rather alarmed by it because, you know, there was this stammery, very, very shy little boy who was obsessed suddenly by a TV show that they thought was diabolically And I mean, bless their hearts, they, you know, they enabled me to do things like go to the Longleat exhibition in 83, and they didn't mind the fact that I was starting to, you know, do audio cassettes and then video it and then watch it over and over and over again. But I know that they thought that I was wasting my time. And that I should be doing more intelligent stuff. But yeah, but for so many years, and the years in which I decided I was going to be a writer, which were in my early teens, strangely, not ever wanting to write Doctor Who particularly, even at that age, I didn't see my dream as being a Doctor Who writer. I also, it was actually, as I say, mostly wanting to write comedy. But Doctor Who, I think, showing me the way that I felt that drama worked. So yeah, it's... It was a very, very big thing. It has. It's astonishing to me that it's been such a big thing now for me for over 40 years, because I would never, even at the time, have predicted that. I always assumed I'd grow out of it, even when I was obsessed by it. Didn't.
Yeah. All, well, probably everyone listening to this podcast is probably in a very similar boat. But
I mean, so I went through phases where I rejected it, you know, not in an awful way, because the show was gone. And so I just assumed it wasn't really a big part of my life anymore. But it, you know, it's always found a way of coming back in. And I accept now it's never going to go away. It's going to be part of my everyday.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. And there are far worse things to be part of your everyday.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
than a silly little show about time and space. So I've sort of put them in these choices in an order, and I guess I've put the novelization of Horror of Frank Rock, which you chose, sort of first, because that's probably on my list as well, because that's that poem, Flannel Isle, and it's probably my first Doctor Who memory, being terrified of the route and going up the lighthouse.
Yeah.
So it's a really big story in my Doctor Who experience. But
it's my second novelization. It's my second novelization. I mean, I could have given my first novelization, and I shall explain why I didn't. Partly because actually you've already covered it. But my what happened was, as I say, I was incredibly scared, and we would go to the W.H. Smiths in Crawley, with, you know, quite a lot. My mum would take me there to go shopping, and I'd go around the book section. So as I say, I had this idea I was going to try a Doctor Who story. And I selected Image of the Fendal for the simple reason that the cover was awful, you know, because it's just not a very good cover at all. And Tom Baker, and I thought, there's no way I can be scared of that because it's just dreadful. And I took it at home. I remember actually reading it in the car and being my heart beating fast because I felt so brave reading it. And it's really not a very nice book, Image of the Fendal. But it's also incredibly short, and I didn't understand it. I still don't understand it, which the Fendal really most of the way through. But it made me feel like I could try another one, and I went out there this time deliberately daring myself to buy the book with what I thought looked like the moodiest, most atmospheric cover, and that was Horror of Frank Rock. And of course, it's a complete coincidence that it's also from season 50. So for a while, I began to believe that Leela and the Doctor were like the default. You know, that every story was going to feature those. Because I remember getting Invasion of Time about third or fourth and thinking, yeah, there they are again. But, you know, those are the key, key lead character. But Horror Fan Rock is genuinely scary. And I adored it. I remember the actual safe thrill of reading that novel where everybody gets picked off one by one, which is great. because there's a sort of elegance to that. And yeah, and at the end of it, the Doctor and Leela, the only survivors, walk away from it. I felt going into it, well, that's what Doctor Who should be. And I suddenly, having been this kid who was scared of anything which, you know, talked about death or anything, I basically wanted every Doctor Who story to feature nothing more than complete carnage. I'd be reading a novelization and be disappointed. You know, I remember reading Monster of Peladon and being very annoyed at the end that Peladon Court wasn't just this sort of, you know, a wash in the blood of every single character. I was annoyed that Alpha Centauri got off free, you know.
I do remember thinking, when's Agador going to go on a rampage? That's why he's there.
And there is a sort of setup in Doctor Who stories as well, you know, that you would, it's not unlike the setup I found in Casualty, you know, that you would open a story and you'd say, yeah, he's going to get killed. You know, it'd be that opening scene or two. You know, I remember when I first saw Curse of Peladon, you know, you think, like, one of these is going to die. Yeah, Torbis, he gets clubbed down by Agador. And the idea of like a sort of, in modern Doctor Who terms, that sort of pre-credits thing, but the early scenes of a Doctor Who story, setting up a character who's going to be slaughtered. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great fun. You know, yeah. I used to get the Radio Times and go through the cast list, wondering which of the characters was going to die first. Yeah, so Horrifying Rock for me was very, very meaningful. And I think Jeff Cummins' cover is gorgeous. And I just...
behind me, in fact, just down at the bottom of my screen.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. I mean, it is beautiful. It's terrific. And yeah,
we were lucky enough to... cut away, we had our dealer's table at Gallifrey One next to Jeff. So we got to know Jeff very well. He's lovely.
He's great, Jeff. I did a convention with Jeff a couple of weeks ago. He was on stage with me. In fact, he admitted that he'd never seen Horrifying Rock. I think maybe until you guys had sent him a copy. At which point he watched it and said he didn't like it. He said it was terrible. He said, it's pointless. Everybody dies. What's the point of the Doctor if he doesn't save anybody? Yeah. Which is a far more adult response than I had when I was 7 years old, when I wanted everything to die.
Narratively, as a sort of adult and a writer, you go, the Doctor failing to save everyone is an unusual an unusual choice.
It is, but also, but I mean, I quite like that if it's not done too often. I mean, when I wrote my Doctor Who things, I always quite liked the idea that the Doctor would on some level be culpable. Or something, that this was actually in some ways that the whole story was a kind of a judgment upon him, that there was something about this actually which was really teasing about. I mean, what I always find a bit difficult with Doctor Who, and it's just because, you know, inevitably that's what most Doctor Who has to be, the idea of the Doctor arriving somewhere, is a superhero, solves all the problems, and then, you know, clears off at the end. That he actually, I quite like the idea of the Doctor being quite frightened. I quite like the idea of the Doctor, in the moment of doing the drama, feeling that he might fail and actually feeling responsible for some of the things which have gone on, which haven't gone well. I've always thought that was more interesting. But if you do it too often, it becomes, you know, meaningless. So, but I like Fang Rock for that. I mean, it is odd, Fang Rock. He doesn't seem to take much responsibility for the fact that it's carnage. I think he doesn't show any great regrets at the end, does he? He just goes.
But he's Tom Baker's Doctor. Tom Baker's Doctor is very alien. He is.
Yeah.
When everyone was complaining about Capaldi, I was like, well, he's acting a lot like Tom Baker.
he's not a great one for remorse, Tom.
Yeah.
He's not that into it. And I think that's actually quite an interesting character point. So, I mean, that's what we always praise for things like Pyramids of Mars, isn't it? It's his reaction to Marcus Scarman's death. Mm. And we always forget as fans that those moments stick out because they don't happen every episode, you know? I mean, Pyramids of Mars was always the way. If he was always having this sort of Iron Man reaction to everything, you'd just get fed up with it. But anyway, but yes, but that novelization, and indeed, you know, I think my happiest childhood memories are looking for Target books. It's, you know, it's going out to the shops. It was finding, remember how hard it was to find a copy of Doctor Who and the Hand of Fear, and being so thrilled when I finally found it. And I remember going on holiday always, you know, we'd always have these British holidays sometimes in caravans, and I'd take maybe a dozen Doctor Who novels to read again. And I would also divide them up into episodes. And then I would write down lists of all the characters who had appeared in, you know, if it was generally every three chapters, because it's, you know, it was usually a 12-chapter book by Terence of four episodes. So you knew where the cliffhangers were. And then I would write down all the characters and then I would do up my own Radio Times cast list for them. I mean, I was obsessed by just the lists. I used to love the lists of them. I still do. I mean, that's still one of my great joys is, I mean, I was at the dentist quite recently. What I do when I'm nervous or whatever, and so I, in my head, recite all the Doctor Who story titles in order. And I can go from An Unearthly Child all the way through now to The Giggle without pausing.
Wow.
And every year when they announce the new ones, I add them to the end of my list in my head. I don't consciously do it. I'm not sitting there thinking, I must remember The Star Beast, Wild Blue Yonder and The Giggle. I just somehow automatically know them. And then I can sit in dental chairs and still do the list in my head. It's weird.
Out now from Cutaway Comics, part two of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form. Set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time. For I am Sutek. Destroyer, sworn enemy of all creation. And creation has many defenders. But this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutek, Sutek, hear me.
Next, this.
Yes, O brother husband. Let my voice guide you back to me and home to Netiquetet.
The land of the dead. And yet, for me, it means life, a reprieve. And for the first time in millennia, a body.
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know. I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane. Even I, my love, wished death upon you. Only now,
you need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk. That brings us on to one of your other choices, which you've cunningly got every single Doctor Who episode.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the Babel Killer YouTube video, which I think the latest version you sent me the link to was up to when Jodie Whittaker had just sort of come in and gone brilliant.
Yeah, he hasn't
so
done
up to 2018.
Covers the the Jodie era. I'm hoping he does.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
was doing it every couple of years. This is a guy called Stuart Humphries who does who is responsible for sort of colorizations and things. But he's done these videos where he just and they're very, very witty, and they use a sort of a mix of the Eurythmics, Sweet Dreams Are Made of This, to the Doctor Who theme shit to do small clips of every single story. And lots of people do these things on YouTube, and they're awful because they just don't have, because they have no sense of drama, no sense of pace. What Stuart's got going is that there's, I can't watch these. If I feel down, I won't stick on a Doctor Who episode. I'll usually stick on a Babel Colour tribute video because it makes me feel enormously proud of Doctor Who to see all of it unfolding in 8 minutes. And I just get this chill, and I feel terribly moved by it. I feel not only because, you know, eventually you get to an episode by me somewhere now in the middle because there are so many stories after nine, but actually mostly just because I just feel, you know, I sat through most of this history unfold, and it just makes me feel so nostalgic. And also it just makes me feel that it's amazing that it's an ongoing program.
Yeah, I just watched it just before we logged onto Zoom, and it really is. It's amazing how much is in our head. Like, I've known these stories since I first had the 10th anniversary thing with Pertwee and the Cybermen and the Sea Devil and the Dalek on the front, and just reading those little paragraphs of each thing, and I've just for some reason memorized them. And seeing all those stories bit by bit.
It's a wonderful comfort blanket sometimes to hold all of Doctor Who in your head. I mean, the honest truth is, in this bunker that you've placed me, I mean, I don't watch Doctor Who back very often. I don't think I've seen most of the new series more than once on broadcast. And I don't watch for pleasure old Doctor Who. What I want to do is watch lots of clips on YouTube. Those are the things actually which really affect me. And so the idea of, In a way, I'm cheating by doing this, because in an odd way, I feel actually I'm grabbing hold of all of Doctor Who in one go. Because that's actually how, you know, genuinely, if I were in a bunker, I know you're not proposing being to send me to a bunker, but if I were in a bunker, I think if I were to watch a story, I just feel the pang of the loss. You know, I wouldn't be able to watch, you know, Androzani without thinking, but where's Twin Dilemma? Because you can't have an Androzani in a very real way without having a Twin Dilemma arc. That's the nature of Doctor Who. So the idea of being able to just say, well, I don't need all of that. I can just have this sort of concertinaed version of the entire history. It makes me very, very happy.
With some quite random quotes. Harry Sullivan is an imbecile. Your own script in the version I watched. Just says elevate.
Brilliant, right? Maybe that's not, or maybe that is the best line I wrote. I mean, I mean, arguably it is. It's funny, really. I remember at the screening for Dalek.
Did you decide to make them shout elevate?
You mean within the script? Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they've done that many times since, haven't they? So yeah, elevate is kind of part of their little repertoire.
It's
exterminate,
isn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, you just feel, well, what they're going to say, it should begin with E and end with E.
Yeah.
You know, you think, oh, well, that would be quite funny.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the thing about all the jokes you write into a script for Russell. You end up expecting them all to be cut. I mean, there was at one point a time when Dalek was actually quite funny. thank God they didn't film that one, because it wasn't actually very good. That's the thing. You know, I remember a journalist came to see when Dalek went out, and there were some quite good lines. And they said to me afterwards, I think meaning to be quite nice, he said, you didn't write that line though, did you? And I said, yeah. And he said, that's awful, that line. I said, is it? I thought it was quite good, that one. He said, no, that's not good. So it is possible that Elevate is the best bit of writing within Dalek.
No, well, I can say, as I think you already know from Lisa McMullen, Dalek has since we've been doing this podcast, Dalek has been picked by more people.
Has it?
And so is Trans. Yeah, and so
Chimes
of Midnight. So
which is rather nice. I mean, I get a real thrill every year on Twitter. Suddenly, people talk about every Christmas. People have a Chimes listen along.
It really is a wonderful thing. But we'll get onto that later.
Yes, of course.
So
I'm jumping ahead.
No, do not worry. We're humans. I'm trying to be too linear. Back to you watching Peter Davison almost sort of as your first Doctor, which someone of our generation, you managed to avoid the grief at Tom Baker no longer being the Doctor, which I still think I've never got over. But you got to enjoy Peter Davison.
Although, you know, it's funny.
Like a five-year-old.
I shared that grief because Castrovalva opens at the end of Legopolis. Mm-hmm. Although it has more upbeat music than Paddy Jones' Legopolis version, instead of saying, "Hey, it's a whole new era," which it is.
Yeah.
But I still find that the most affecting generation because it's kind of perfect, and all those clips are great. But it's not just the clips; it's obviously the sense of something momentous taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into the Davison years, even at that stage, I always felt that it was a response to this Doctor that I hadn't dared watch. And I remember, you know, there was a certain joy in watching Doctor Who and realising I didn't have to be frightened of it. I was only actually ever frightened of Doctor Who going out live as a fan once, and that was in Kinder.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Sanders opens the box and his face lights up red. He's been given the box by Karuna. And I found that actually quite frightening. And then I was surprised at myself because I'd stopped being frightened by it. By the time that, you know, that I was watching things like Earthshock and, you know, grieving for Adric's death, I was no longer frightened by it. I was just excited by it.
But in
part, that was because it felt to me like Davison had allowed me to make Doctor Who my own. And then I could go back, which I did. You know, I mean, I got into, by the time I was 13, 14, I was at conventions and people were swapping video cassettes with me. So I was watching old, really, really bad quality copies of Tom Baker and John Pertwee and stuff and William Hartnell, not much Troughton, and loving it, but also feeling that this was now, you know, that Davison had given me permission to like these and accept these as well, which was funny. So, if that makes any sense.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters, Issue 1, Faustine, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega, El Trala, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
Yeah, so one of your choices is the Davison and his Snake Dance. I guess Kinder and Snake Dance, do you...
No.
Do you find it hard to choose between the two? Or
no.
They're both great, I think.
I think Kinder is arguably... I think most people would say Kinder is the better. But Snake Dance is the one that I love. Snake Dance is what you said earlier on about wanting to be a writer. Snake Dance is the script that, when I was that age, I suddenly realised how skillful the dialogue was. I think it's also, you know, I mean, there's a bit where Tala, Lon's mother, talks about her marriage, which is so subtle, but makes it so clear about this sort of this very strange, cold relationship she has that she daren't admit. I mean, I talk about it, I think, on the DVD documentary. When I was, you know, breaking into writing scripts on my own, I kept on remembering that there was this scene where she goes off into a sort of nostalgic little bit of wistfulness and how he was appalled by the snake dancers, and she chuckles and then says, "Even then." And that those words, "even then," for me, just as a 12, 13-year-old, summed up this, just opened this, the idea of these people being real and having genuine regrets. And Stay Dance is so full of, it's such a delicate script, and it's also so genuinely eerie and mind-expanding, and it's so clever. I mean, this is a story. I was so excited going into the anniversary season because we've been told by Celestial Toy, you know, the DWAS newsletter, that every story was going to have something from the past. And the season's so clever because actually it's basically critiquing nostalgia. I mean, Snake Dance and Mortian Undead in particular. I mean, Mortian Undead is amazing because it brings back the Brigadier and then makes it quite clear the Brigadier not only doesn't remember the Doctor, which of course he does later, but even after that, it's just, it's a catalogue of Benton now going off and selling secondhand cars. It's about the fact that this isn't just, we're going back and celebrating all of our, it's about the show having become just sort of older and a bit more tired. It's, Snake Dance is all about the dangers of nostalgia for a programme about to celebrate its anniversary. It's about the, there's something amazing about even the bit where the Mara tries to take control of Ambrel by breaking lots of pots, which is so much, which is genuinely based upon the idea of, well, how would you get someone like Ian LeVay to sell out his country, is that you take him to a place and destroy Tomb of the Cybermen. I mean, it was actually, that's a direct thing that they were doing. And I was that age. I mean, I was, you know, even at that point, I remember praying to God. I didn't even believe in God, saying that he could have some years of my life if he brought back Tomb of the Cybermen. And it worked. I mean, annoying. I've actually lost 5 years of my life for that.
Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yeah, and I wish I'd known. I mean, I wish I could have, you know, bargained. Right. I mean, I'd have said to God, "Give me 10. I'll give you 10 years of my life for the whole of the archives." But I was stupid. 4 episodes, and that's what we got back. But there is a sense in which, you know, watching it at that age, I kind of understood suddenly just how sophisticated this was. And watching it back, which I did a while back, it still is. It's a genuinely beautiful, cleverly directed, brilliantly acted story with a really, really subtle script from a writer who was never going to write any more TV again because he'd been told he was a failure. And it breaks my heart, Snakes. It is such a talented piece of work, and it's generally ignored. And it's without doubt my favourite bit of Doctor Who, full stop. I mean, I'm not saying it's the best Doctor Who story ever made, because I don't think it is. I think there are better Davison stories than Snyder. You know, qualitatively, I think Angrisani is probably much better. But Snake Dance is the one that I always, if I watch Snake Dance, I end up crying a bit because I'm always so moved by how hard it's punching when it has no reason to be punching quite as hard as that. I think it is a tremendously good Doctor story.
Well, I remember being scared of it because I was just that bit younger than you. And it was only, I remember being scared of the skull in the mirror on Tegan's shoulders.
That's a great image.
Just amazing.
And it's also full of images. I mean what I love about it as well is that Kinder, I mean, I think Christopher Bailey would say this himself. I mean, you know, it's written by a man who's not really written TV before. And it's full of things where you know, and it's full of little errors. I mean, we always remember how great Janet Fielding is in Snake Dance and Kinder, but she spends 10 minutes under the Mars influence in Kid, and then she has episode 3 and she's entirely asleep. I mean, it doesn't really know how to use its characters so well. And it's not especially visual. Whereas Snake Dance is full of these incredible visual images. You know, the whole Hall of Mirrors thing is really, really atmospheric, and it's full of stuff that, you know, now that I write horror, that I would write entire stories based around the ideas. You know, the idea of someone going down a hall of mirrors and looking in a mirror and their head being replaced by the skull of a snake is beautifully eerie and weird. And even that really, really strange opening of episode 1, you just zoom in increasingly upon this man in a trance.
Yeah.
That's weird. I mean, it's so unlike the actual visual style of what we expect Doctor Who to be. And then there's that, you know, minutes later, you've got that wonderful bit where Tegan's in her dream and they sort of just have her, through special effects, go up the steps, and then she steps into it anyway. And it's so strange and brave what they're doing, and it works. It's so good. And everything about Kinder was people at the time laughing at how bad the snake was. Snake Dance is saying, we don't care about that. We're going to do brave things, and if you find it funny because it's strange, then you're not in on the joke of it. I mean, it's really good. And it's so underrated as well. It's such an underrated piece of TV.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Yeah,
it's a really great piece of TV.
Yeah, well, watching it as a grown up. I mean, I've watched it several times, but I watched it yesterday, and it really is like you were saying, just the characters are really well drawn.
Mm.
You know, quite often with some classic, that you just have a bunch of ciphers walking around, don't you? They don't do what modern television would do as a matter of course, which is make sure everyone has stuff to do because they were writing so quickly. I mean, there is the Nyssa go and stay in the TARDIS bit, which is a bit pointless. But apart from that, it's really well put together. All the characters are brilliant. Kind of reminded me of I, Claudius in some sort of ways. That sort of, Martin Clunes as a sort of Caligula kind of bored emperor.
And he's fantastic.
Oh, he really is.
The fact was that people are taking it so seriously and yet John Carlson's, he's very funny as that. But he's doing a really, really clever job for portraying a man who's not a villain, who would normally be a villain. I mean, all these characters who are obstructions to the Doctor would normally, therefore, be villains.
Mm.
But he's just a man who sees the Doctor as anybody else would, as this crazy man ranting on a bus.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how I would be. You know, I mean, that's the thing about drama generally, I think, is that drama is usually about writing people as heroes that in real life you wouldn't be able to stand. If someone gets up, you know, I just want a quiet life. I mean, that's the danger of it, because you look around, particularly this country at the moment, and I wish I were more of a rebel. But in real life, I'm the person who allows bad things to happen because I never stand up and object, because those people are always annoying. And so Amber is just basically watching the Doctor rant on about the return of the Mara, and he just looks like he's a nutter. And that's the joy of it, is that they're not malicious people. They're just ordinary people who are looking at, who find themselves suddenly, much to their complete bafflement, in the closing minutes of part four, only time I've ever realised it. Up until the end of part four, they still don't realise that they're in a Doctor Who again, you know, where crazy things happen, where monsters come back. It's just nonsense. And actually, that's one of the great skills of Smith, as well, as that when it ends, it ends. You don't have sequences. I think they filmed them, but you don't actually have them broadcast, where the characters go up to the Doctor and say, yep, turns out you were right, that 500-year-old manifestation of the snake was dangerous. They don't do that because they go back to real life.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels so grounded. It's such a clever thing. And again, as I say, I keep coming back to the idea that it was Doctor Who at 20 years, basically saying, I don't know that it's wise to keep on harping on about the past. or at least being so complacent about the past, which is what Stagnance is about complacency. And that's a very odd thing for Doctor Who to be talking about.
Yeah, I love that the Mara
really
is...
I really love it. I really, really love it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great one. Yeah. It really is. I love that the Mara is, you know, the Mara is the distillation of all the negative things from the Sumerian society, and
it's one of those funny things that it's hard to imagine the Mara in a story with another Doctor Who monster. You know, especially the way that things are now, where you get stories like Flux, which even take the Weeping Angels and put them into a story, which again felt to me like an elemental menace that wouldn't exist in another Doctor Who story. The idea that you can't imagine the Mara and the Daleks teaming up, because they would just feel like they're part of separate story universes. And that's what I love about Mara, is it doesn't feel like a standard Doctor Who villain. It feels like it's its own thing, which is the beauty of Doctor Who being an anthology series, is it can do that. I think it's so good. And it's one of my proudest things, and one of the reasons also I selected it, I suppose, was that, you know, years and years ago, whenever it was, 12 years ago, when they brought out the DVD of it, and they dragged me to one of these things to sit on a chair in a studio somewhere and chat about it to a green screen. And there was this guy at the back of the room. And I was saying how much I loved it and how much it made me want to be a writer. And he came up to me, this chap, and just said, did you mean any of that? Or was that just guff? You know, the sort of stuff you just... I said, no, I genuinely mean that. And he said, well, I'm Christopher Bailey. And they filmed us. I mean, it wasn't meant to be. I mean, it's now on the new Blu-ray that's just come out. And it was... They put it as a DVD Easter egg because it wasn't intended to be there. They didn't film it very well. It's not up to the usual standards. But they just suddenly, Chris and I just sat on the sofa and talked about it because we just met in that moment and they wanted to capture it. And it was really moving because he had spent all these years believing that he'd failed. And I was just telling him how much Snake Dance and Kinder meant not only to me, but to other people. I mean, Stephen Moffat loves them as well. And we'd often talked about it, Stephen and I, how much we love those stories and how influential they've been on us when we were, you know, young people trying to start out as writers. So it's a very, very happy memory for me. For so many reasons.
You were at the BFI screening of The Five Doctors, weren't you? I think I saw you there.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
A few weeks ago. Yeah.
And some of the extras on the Blu-ray do look amazing. Martin Clunes talking about how Janet Fielding would, Janet Fielding didn't give in to his advances. Yeah, try as he might, she wouldn't give in.
It's a really, really lovely extra that. I mean, and that's something else to celebrate, which of course I'm not doing this, but the fact that we're getting those Blu-rays, there is no TV program ever that is being given the adoration and that sense of completism that old Doctor Who is. It's something that, again, had my 12, 13-year-old self. If he could have imagined what would be available to me as a 53-year-old, these things that I loved so much, I think I would have just never stopped crying. Partly because I wouldn't have had it then. I mean, I would have loved it then. Idea of having all these extras, these amazing documentaries, and just the warmth of it. Just, you know, it's astonishing what they're doing.
It is wonderful, but I am one of the we. Even I'm just like, it's like just doing a bit of research for this, and you find out everything's through the prism of Doctor Who, and it's like you look up John Carson, and one of the main things it says about him is he's married to Daleks Master Plan guest actress Pamela Greer, just like everything's Doctor Who,
and that's a danger in and of itself. I mean, when I began working in theatre, I mean, one of the first things I did with Aikborn was a play which featured the actor Peter Laird.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to say to Peter only once we'd opened, because I made a mistake in previous productions of telling people early on in rehearsals I knew they were Doctor Who once. And you could see that they lost a lot of respect for you as a writer. If you were able to say things like, you were in the paradise of death, and they'd say, yes. And they didn't like you anymore. So I said to Peter Laird one night in the bar after it opened, I said, you were Chang in the Wheel in Space. and he said, yes. He said, I used to play a lot of Chinaman because I've got a round face. And he talked about the process of doing things which were entirely racist in Doctor Who back in 1968. I mean, wonderful stuff. But yeah, it is that sort of funny thing. It all comes back to Doctor Who. I mean, it's that dreadful thing that you're aware that, you know, like we had this week with the death of Michael Gambon and Harry Potter subsumes his career suddenly, or when Ian Holm died and Lord of the Rings became... It's Lord of the Rings actor dies, and they've had such amazing careers. And you have to be aware that if you touch Doctor Who in any form, it's going to be the thing which is on your epitaph. I mean, I'm resigned to that, but there's nothing I can do that is ever going to have the same sort of impact. There are things I'll do which I hope, I think, are better than what I did in Doctor Who, but you're also aware that you can't fight it, and it would be resentful to do so. I remember when they cast, I'm sure they won't mind me saying this, but when they cast James Bolam, who I'd worked with on my first TV, Chris Chibnall, but they cast him in The Spectre of Lanyon Moore, Big Finish, and he was advertised on the website by somebody as being James Bolam, who is best known to Doctor Who fans as being married to Susan James, who was once cast but then wasn't in Colony in Space as Captain Dent. You think, it's James Bolam. You know, James Bolam is rather bigger than the fact he's married to someone who wasn't once in Doctor Who. But every credit gets turned into a Doctor Who credit eventually. You know, that's the way you announce stuff. I remember when we did, I did a Big Finish called Deadline, starring Derek Jacobi. And I was amazed when that was announced, because I was a massive iCordius fan. And I was so excited to be working with Derek Jacobi. And I was amazed that there was a sort of collective shrug from so many Doctor Who fans, because there was no Doctor Who connection with Derek Jacobi. Whereas in that range, they also had David Collins, who was great, don't get me wrong, But they could say, well, he was Vorst in Revenge of the Cybermen, who were robots of death, and Mordred. And just say, yeah, but it's not Derek Jacobi. And it was that funny thing that, for, you know, that it's very easy to allow Doctor Who to be the only thing which defines the act. I mean, I had the same thing. I remember when I was a kid watching a Juliet Bravo. It's actually what I made my audio deadline about it. I mean, watching Robert Holmes having written a Juliet Bravo offended me. I mean, that was where it came from, that audio. I mean, I was there at home, turned on the TV, Juliet Bravo started, and you know, and that music, and then it, there's an episode title, and it's by Robert Holmes. And I thought, well, what's he doing that for? Why is he? And it was and it was the fact, actually, not only was I offended by it, it was the fact that I realised how much I genuinely didn't care about having any other credits. It's the way now, if I do a convention and I have my own stuff there, you know, if I have my short story collections, whatever, I always warn fans who come up and say, they're not Doctor Who, because I don't see why they should have to take any interest in my other work because it's not Doctor Who. I mean, I didn't. When I was a young fan, I did not care remotely about other people's credits outside the show. So, because I just didn't, I thought it was disloyal of them, frankly. I thought that they shouldn't be doing anything else except Doctor Who. And so, you know, that was the end of it.
Yeah, how dare they pay their mortgage?
I mean, you know, Malcolm Hulk doing Crossroads. Well, the hell with you, Malcolm Hulk.
Yeah. Tune in next week for the second half of this interview with Robert Sherman.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.